So obviously, last time we were here, we had to rip very quickly through some of the last, through what was going to be the main thrust of the class, but through my mismanagement turned into something less. But back to the original point that we wanted to talk to, and we are continuing in our series, and this should probably represent the peak portion of the first half of the series, How Does Science Help You Be a Better Christian? So we had said that seems like a very broad thing to talk about. How can science make you be a better Christian? You have to have more specific goals. In that case, the goal was, let's talk about the central tenet of Christianity. And when we talk about the central tenet of Christianity, almost everybody says what? You say, what's the central tenet of Christianity? Everybody answers?
Love.
If you've been in this class, yes, thank you. Rats. But that's the answer I'm looking for. But almost everybody says the gospel. The gospel is the central tenet of Christianity. The gospel is central in one way, in that there is only one way to get back in full communication with God. But that's not the goal. The goal isn't to be saved. That is a step in the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is a relationship with God that leaves you as happy as you can possibly be, and although my other gentleman who's asking about it isn't here, living forever. So immortality and happiness, we said, are really the goals of humanity. They're the things we desire most. And that relationship with God in love and a relationship with others in love is, in fact, the end goal of what we're looking for. So the gospel, while indispensable, while critical, while foundational, is not the whole deal. And this is one of the problems with Christianity, in this humble guy's opinion, or not so humble guy's opinion, unfortunately, on occasion, is we turn around and say, here we are, we're fallen sinners, we're living in a sinful world, what do we need to do? We need to get saved. And so we get saved, and we're like, that's it, we're saved, that's terrific, I'm a Christian. That starts you. That's like saying, I want to be a Marine, I want to do Marine things, I want to be in the military. I go to boot camp. I've signed up to go to boot camp. Hooray, I'm in the military. We just started. And hopefully there's no boot camp in Christianity, or it'd be a lot less popular than it is today. But ultimately, because what we're trying to do is go somewhere, we can't forget that things like salvation, that things like sanctification, that things like all these Christian words we're using are ways to get to where we want to be. And at the end of the day, where we want to be is this. Living in a community of love that is so remarkable that it is joined entirely by volunteers. It's the ultimate way to, quote-unquote, take over the world. Because everybody wants, right now you can look in the news and see people fighting back and forth for control of the world or parts of the world or pieces of the world. Everybody knows, I think, deep down in their hearts, that never works. Even if you conquer your way to ownership of the whole world, that doesn't fix the problem. What actually fixes the problem is an all-volunteer world where everybody wants to do the right thing. And the only way to set that up, and this is why I think that God makes love so central, is a society that's based on selflessness and benevolence being the two core tenets, which are the two indispensable parts of the definition of love. Love is a regard for another person that is benevolent and selfless. If you don't have both of those things, it's not love. It's something else. It might be admirable, but it's not love. So, that being the case, we talked about two things: how do we love God, and how do we love other people? And two classes ago, we set some specific goals of saying we're not going to do it all at one time. And we used a term for those, I know there's a couple new faces in the class, so bear with me for a second for those who've heard this before. We talked about the difficulty of loving people. Loving God shouldn't be that hard in some respects, unless you blame God for my mother died when I was young, this particular loss happened in my life, I'm struggling with X and I blame God for it. In that case, yes, there's some things to get past before one can love God. But God is someone that shouldn't be offending you too much. It doesn't seem like he actively tries to offend anybody, if I'm reading the scriptures correctly. The others part is hard. The others part is hard because there are some people who are easy to love. If you have especially if you're newly married, you're still gazing fondly into the other person's eyes, you haven't irritated each other to date, whatever it may be, it should be easier to love that person than it is, say, somebody at work who seems to be a quote-unquote enemy. But the mandate from God is to love whom? When we listen to Jesus' words, who's he telling us to actively love?
Everybody.
And he puts even a premium on loving the unlovable people. He says, don't even the Gentiles basically treat their friends well, but you need to love your enemies. And Paul writes to us that that Christ shows us his ultimate love in that while we were yet sinners, he died for us. We were enemies of God, he died for us. So imagine giving your life for an ISIS guy, giving your life for an Al-Qaeda guy, giving your life for the person at work that you hate the most. That's what Jesus did for us, which is why the loving the God part ought to be a little bit easier. But as human beings who are not completely holy yet, sometimes it's hard to love people. And I likened what we're trying to do here to a workout regimen. If you're going to work out, you want to get the form correct. You don't want to walk right into the gym on day one and try to throw up 300 pounds in your bench press or 600 pounds in a deadlift. That's an Olympic level lift, and you have to go through an Olympic training program to get there. We're not an Olympic training program. We're just starting out. We're just trying to be healthy. So in that case, what we said was pick somebody that's easy for you to love, and we're going to work on the form. And then we said later, we're going to recommend how to work your way towards what we call the Olympic lift, figuring out how to love that unlovable person. Because if you really do buy off on the doctrines of God, you have a duty by the person who has saved you. Once he has saved you and you say to him, thank you for that, what do you want me to do? He said, love the unlovable person. He said, love everybody, but love the unlovable person too. So we want to get there because we want to be obedient to the one that we acknowledge as master. That's the background on this in a nutshell. So we identified some things that we wanted to do about both sets of people. We said in order to love somebody, you have to know them because you have to know what they need and what they want. So hopefully what you have done, and by the way, what I would like to, so anybody can prepare themselves who's done this over the last week or two, can you tell us if you have done this, how it worked out? So if anybody wants to report back on we tried this, this is how it works so far, then please do. So we said in the case of both people, you want to know them a little bit better. You want to decide what the goal is, and the goal in this case is something that's going to be benevolent, and the goal is something that is going to be selfless, especially in this one. In this, we're really talking about what's something you want to know about God. That's what we asked you to look at last time. In this case, we want to say, we need to find out from the person, we should know it, if it's our easier lift, we should know the person well enough, probably by now, to say, this is what they want and or need. And we talked a little bit last time about the difference between want and need. It's not always the same. Your two-year-old kid may want to sit and eat cookies all day long. So you might say, well, I'm going to love them by being selfless and deferring to them. Well, you're not being benevolent because 30 minutes later, they're going to feel badly because they've got sugar rush, sugar crash, and upset stomach. So at some point, we want to decide what is selfless and what is benevolent. So these were and then we had an action goal after this. But what I want to do is take a quick aside and get into the science portion again. I'm going to restate briefly something we did in the previous class, and then we're going to talk about how it applies here, and then want to hear some of the stories as to how it went, and if not, I'll share a couple myself. But what we had said was, if you're going to do an action, there has to be some level of preparation. Now, we know this in physical training, like swinging a bat at a baseball. You get what we call muscle memory, which, of course, is not a memory stored in your muscle. It's a brain function. So you have to rewire your brain in such a way that you can go from, I swing at this thing after it's passed by me 2 seconds ago, to I'm making contact with this ball. That kind of brain rewiring takes practice, and it takes mental effort. Preparation can be really key. I told a story about as a young pilot, a 17-year-old pilot, I was going to go fly an aerobatic plane for the first time. I was already a regular pilot, and I watched a video that shows it from the cockpit view, and I flew the maneuvers probably 100 times a piece. And then when I sat in the plane and flew it, I didn't fly them flawlessly, but I flew them better than anybody that guy had ever seen. And he assumed I'm the greatest natural pilot of all time. In reality, I wasn't. I'm an average pilot. But I had practiced it so many times that the first time I did the action, I was good at it. I was passable at it. So preparation, we also talked about its neurological signatures. So the last bit of review we'll do, and then we'll get into new material after this. I had participated in a study. I brought human subjects to a study where they compared ROTC cadets versus super special operation ninjas. I got them some of the best guys that have ever come down the pipe. They put them in, they did an MRI scan on them, they showed them a bunch of threat stuff, basically, or stuff that should make you feel badly. The ROTC kids, here's kind of a rough brain, forebrain, rear brain. You'll see a lot of brain activation back here in this area when people are observing. you'll see activation usually in these two little spots up here, but sometimes it'll ring out a little bit. And this is the what we call the it's not entirely broken down by this, but roughly broken down like this. This is the frontal cortex and the prefrontal cortex, where a lot of the cognition goes on, a lot of the, I'm having to think about this problem right now, as I'm saying things and you're having to think about them, you've got a fair amount of forebrain activity going on. In the military, you don't want any forebrain activity going on, because what you want is observe, and the preparation's already happened, so they're not having to, and it doesn't exactly work like this, but imagine that this is observe, and this is decide. And this isn't where it's located. Let's put just a center block in here. We'll call this memory. What you actually want having to go on is when you observe something happening. Now, this we're loving somebody thing. This is we see the need that they have. We don't want to turn around and think and decide. I have to think about it and decide what I'm going to do in this situation. What you actually want is for that to be muscle memory. The ball comes across the plate, you swing at it. The enemy pops up, you shoot at it. You see a wounded person, you drop what you're doing, you pick up your med kit, and you go to it. The special operations troops only activated back here. There's hardly any activity up here. The ROTC cadets activated all up here after a brief flashback here, and almost no activity, comparatively, between the two. What that told us was the special operators already knew what to do. It was already programmed in their mind. They knew what to go after, and they were observing to get the maximum amount of detail that they needed in the second and a half they were making that observation to inform this, basically to hit this set of memories. And the memory was basically going to tell you, not exactly, but the memory was basically going to tell you what to do. And for that reason, that's the difference between a special operations, and there's some natural stuff to it, and there's some learned stuff to it, so there's a little bit of both that goes in there. But at the end of the day, this is what you want. You want observation hitting memory. You don't want observation hitting rational faculties. You want to use your rational faculties when you're not in the situation. A great example of this is, think of an argument you've been in. You ever been in an argument with somebody that you love, you don't want to, if you're outside the argument, you might say something like this: I would never want to offend this person. I love them very much. I never want to say anything hurtful to them. Yet you're in this argument. There's all kinds of brain chemicals happening, and you say something that you instantly regret or learn to regret later. Never happened to anybody in this room, right? I see a fellow sharer of my mutations back there, and if she and I come from the same populace, we are well famous for the ability during an argument to do lots of damage. My family was particularly good at that. But bonus on you if you've overcome that genetic limitation that I know I certainly have. When we are in those situations where we are not making our decision ahead of time, where we're making our decision in the fight, you almost always make a bad decision. The best way to love a person is to already feel and regard them in a certain way before you get into the situation. You don't try to figure out how to love them there, or you don't just say to yourself this: I'm going to love that person no matter what. And then you stop thinking about it. And then when you get in the situation, you're like, well, I'm going to love this person. But what's the problem? You don't know how. That's like saying, well, I'm mentally prepared myself for that. When I step in that batter's box, I'm going to swing at the ball. And you step in the batter's box for the first time ever, you try to swing at the ball and you didn't even see it coming. You have to practice it. You have to mentally rehearse it at a minimum. And so that mental rehearsal is something that we can also call meditation. And when I say meditation, I mean it. Meditation. I mean it in the most pure scientific form of the word meditation. I don't mean a spiritual meditation. I'll say it that way. I want to differentiate the two. Not because they shouldn't be the same, but because of popular culture, they have divided. Meditation, true meditation, is nothing more than mentally preparing yourself for what you're going to do. Locker room video, as you're watching guys prior to either an MMA fight, to a football game, to a soccer match or whatever, tell me the kinds of things you see in there. What does it look like in that locker room? Some guys are getting the nervousness out of themselves. Dennis used to throw up. This is him being nervous, and he works his way through, thinks about it. He's already thinking about it. He wouldn't throw it up if he wasn't already thinking about it. So he thinks about it, he throws up, and by the time he walks back on the court or the field, something has changed in his mind, and now he's ready on the good days. On the bad days, you step back on the field, you're not ready yet. What other kind of stuff do we see guys doing? Sorry, say again, Dennis.
There were never any bad days.
Never any bad days, all right. Then he had it right. What are some other things we see doing?
So you like shadow box where you're going through the moves, even though you don't have an opponent there with you.
You'll see world-class boxers. They do not need any more practice. It's not like they're about to get in the fight. They're like, man, you know, I needed 17 hours of practice before this fight. I'm at 16 hours and 45 minutes. Let me get my last 15 minutes in. What are they doing? They are mentally saying, when I see this, this is what I'm going to do. Or when I initiate, this is what I'm going to do. And he's training his brain. We say we're psyching ourselves up. What we really mean is we are mentally preparing for this situation. When you're going to go and learn to love somebody, you do this right here on its own. This is why we see who needs no rehearsal of being good. I'll give you a possible candidate, Jesus. Okay, so he ought to be a guy, if anybody, that can walk into the situation and know it. How frequently did we see Jesus leaving the disciples, leaving the people that he is ministering to, leaving the people that he's giving a communication to the kingdom to, and go off on his own by himself? If you read the Gospels and you look for that, you'll realize he's doing that all the time. Half the time the disciples are like, we don't know where he is, where is he at? He spends 40 days before he kicks off on his ministry in the wilderness, fasting. I mean, that's a different level of mental preparation where I say I'm only going to focus on this and there's some other stuff to it as well. But that kind of meditation, that kind of mental preparation, if you think that you can do it without doing this, if you think you can be successful at any task in this world without doing this, you're not paying attention. Athletes do this. Military people do this. Spiritual people like Jesus do this. This ought to be common sense for us, and somehow it has left the common sense realm and it's become something special and extra. So people will say things like, well, some people are good at meditation and prayer, but I'm good at action or whatever. If you're not good at meditation and prayer, you're not good at action. You're good at action sometimes, maybe accidentally, but you're nowhere near as good as you could be if you did those things. So all that to say, that's kind of my case for why we're going, what some of the science is that we want to use in this practice. And the other couple things I gave you was, just like in the military, you've got a scuba buddy. In working out, you've got a lifting partner or a coach. You know, the kind of, you've got somebody there to support and encourage you thing should be pretty consistent through there. So you see that consistently through all kinds of endeavors that we do. When you're learning to love others and when you're learning to love God, you should be doing that same thing too by having a partner who's there. We call them accountability partners in Christianity. Terrible name. And if that's all they're doing is holding you accountable, I mean, imagine that the only job of the coach is you get done lifting for the week and he picks up the phone and he's like, hey, I just want to check and make sure you did your workouts this week. How much value is that? Maybe a little bit, because you're like, well, at the end of the week I have to report back to this guy. But beyond that, it's not going to be hard to get around. So an accountability partner, in reality, a lifting partner is what I've called it, is there with you when you do your work, or is there with you when you prepare to do your work, one of the two. So I would argue that the preparation stage for loving somebody else is way more important than we've ever thought. So did anybody try kind of this methodology over the course of the last week or two, and if so, how did it go? Now that I've raised the bar and basically said, if we're not.
Yes, I tried it. And I've meditated before on things, you know, to psych myself up to do some activity that might not be a normal activity, like watching TV. I don't think anybody has to psych up to do that, do you?
If you're to watch TV right, I guess. I don't know what that means. What
would it look like? Yeah, if you're in a proper meditative state, you can sit there for hours and hours and watch that thing.
Right.
But otherwise, if you don't want to do that, you know, if you want to, like, you know something about God, which is one of the things that I was attempting to do, and then, you know, setting some goal, and then, you know, like, how can I love my wife more? You know, I mean, she's a great, wonderful person. Do I do her justice? I don't think so.
Right.
I mean, seriously, that's what I think. I don't think so. You know,
okay.
I mean, sometimes I'm all over the place, and I'm short with her, curt. You know, I don't extend courtesies. You know, things like that. I mean, does reading Shakespeare improve my disposition to my wife? Well, no, it doesn't. Nothing does. But my sitting there and focusing or meditating on how I can do that does help.
Okay, good.
It really does help.
Yes, sir.
Well, I've got three candidates for people that are impossible to honor. And one of them would be in the Hall of Fame. It'd be Hitler, Eichmann, and Mengele.
Yep.
Hitler and Eichmann, obviously bad people. But Mengele would be worse because whereas Hitler and Eichmann were like the givers of the orders, they were in charge of getting rid of the Jews. But Mengele was actually hands-on.
Right.
I don't see how in the world you could possibly get yourself to the point where you could love the angel of death, Mengele.
No, that's a great question. How do you get to the point where you love somebody who's actively doing vicious and cruel things to you? Do you know, do we know anybody that was in those kind of situations and did it? If so, who were they? Anybody read Anne Frank's diary?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So if you read the diary of Anne Frank, or I'm forgetting the two ladies who were also Holocaust
survivors. Right. They had a children's play that was about them.
Yeah. They are people who as they are walking, I remember the two ladies particularly were walking, extremely embarrassed and being degraded. They're completely naked in line with a bunch of other women. They're going to go have their head shaved, all this other stuff. They told them they're going into the showers, and they knew about the gas chambers, and these in fact were showers. But all this horrible stuff's going on, and they are trying to figure out how do you survive through this, and B, what should you do? And they identified with what Christ had identified. And one of the sisters said to the other, as they were embarrassed and shamed and naked, it hit for her too, that on the cross so was Jesus. And she said to her sister, he was naked too. And that helped them through the whole thing. At the end of the day, they could look at the guards and say, we forgive you. They could ask God, Lord, forgive them, because they don't know what they do. Without the example of Christ, I agree, it is maybe impossible. I certainly couldn't do it. So the only way that I can do it is, and I'll go back to the old pulpit language to say, when we fix our eyes on Jesus, when we actually use him as an example, it, in my mind, there are two, you can, if you get put in the Nazi camp, you can focus on what would Captain America do in here, or you can focus on what Jesus would do. And that's an actual thing that you have to do. You have to decide what it is that you're going to do, and that has to do with God, who God has made you and all that kind of thing too. But bottom line is, without the example of Christ, it may not be possible. But back to my question, has anybody done this in a way that worked in the last couple weeks? So I'll give you an example. And this is what I call an easy lift for me. This is not an Olympic lift. This is me trying to love my wife. But it recognizes a limitation that I have. So my father's family, I think I've said before in this class, are cruel people. They use words as weapons, and they were very good at it. And so I grew up, now he left that willingly, walked away from it, and said, I'm not going to be like that. And he became a Christian, a true Christian, has worked really hard. But he comes from that background. So when he gets tired and upset and all that kind of stuff, he's still got a little bit of that in him. So I saw that growing up, which means I need to recognize that I've got that a little bit set as an example for me too. So it is, and I've watched it happen at work or in the military when the situation gets tough and I want to make something happen for me, I can use words as a weapon, and they can be really hurtful too to that other person. Sometimes in the military you might say, well, you're in the middle of some military thing, that's the way it's supposed to be, don't worry about it. I don't agree that that's the case, but at least it was accepted a little bit more there. Where it's not accepted on anybody's level is where I just say anything sharp, harsh, cruel, or in kind of an intense voice to my wife. I know I don't want to do that. When something happens, and I realize I don't get upset at her, I'm actually getting upset at dumb parts of the situation of something going on. So kid A is crying.